Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is singer, actor, recording artist, and now writer Sam Harris. The Sand Springs native first came to prominence as the first winner of Star Search, television's first reality talent competition. Has since gone on to a multi-platinum recording career with Tony-nominated stage and television roles, producing and directing in television, and a performing career that has now spanned three decades. His latest project is an autobiographical set of essays titled Ham, Slices of a Life. It's by turn a very funny, poignant, and moving collection of stories about growing up in Oklahoma and being, as he puts it, more interested in Broadway and singing than football, and of being gay and feeling utterly alone. Striving to make a career, the 5 years of struggling to become an overnight success on Star Search, and of great and not so great experiences in show business, from headlining Oprah's first post 9/11 show, Music to Heal Our Hearts, to a hilariously dysfunctional gig opening for Aretha Franklin in a blizzard. He also discloses the demons in his own life and how he worked to overcome them. He's in the midst of a nationwide tour of what he calls a litter-usical, mix of a literary and musical event. He just performed this past Saturday night in Tulsa, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Sam Harris, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here, my old friend.
And yes, it is. We have to disclaimer up front, we grew up together.
We did.
And this book, Ham, first of all, having known you from the time a lot of the stories took place, I can tell you they're absolutely true as far as my recollection goes. In fact, your recollection is a lot better than mine. What made you decide to write your stories?
I'd always written for plays and for television and certainly for my own concerts that I always do a lot of comic monologue and stuff, and a few essays here and there. But the idea of a book sounded really ominous, you know, really large. And my friend Frank Langella, the actor, had put out a book and had known some of my writing. He said, Sam, you just need to be writing. You need to be doing it. Just do it without result in mind, without what it's supposed to be. You know, because in my business, everything is a pitch to sell, to do, to go, to be. And he said, just do it. Just start. And I started writing the stories, and I would send them to him. And he would write back, great, go deeper, explore this and that.
And so Frank Langella was your editor.
He was my initial editor. He was the godfather of this. And then he started telling me, you know, and after that was like in April of 2012. And within three, I'm a really fast writer, but I could tweak until you wrench the pages from my hand. but after a few months, I had a stack, you know, 80 pages or something. And I couldn't help it. And so I did start sort of showing it to people. And by August, I was flying to New York to meet with book agents who were interested, and then I sold it in September to Simon & Schuster. I mean, it was super fast, and then finished everything. And it was really cakey. It went smoother than most. I consider this show business, too, than most other
yes,
media.
Yes, it is.
So, I write fast, and it was picking the stories, just kind of getting them out. And as you know, the book is not chronological.
No, it's episodic.
Yeah.
It's they're really essays about your life.
Yeah. Childhood, growing up in Oklahoma, then their show business, then their parenting, then their, you know, all throughout.
And is that something are you very introspective normally?
I'm actually the person that friends say that I don't remember anything.
Yeah, that's kind of amazing because you remember everything.
When I really focus on it, but you know what it is? I think it's probably also as an actor, I use real specifics, sounds and smells and the color of the sky and and so when I really went to places that were a long time ago, then I was able to just really find the specifics.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to come home to Oklahoma to sort of?
I didn't, but I did. I didn't have to come home to Oklahoma, but I did at one point come, and I sort of did a little tour around to where the baseball, the Little League baseball field
right.
was, and where
which is now like apartments and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. and so I did sort of go around to different places just to sort of reignite.
Yeah. In the course of it, you tell the story of growing up here, and this is something I knew about you, but even like at age six, when we were like 6 years old, uh-huh. I knew you wanted to be a star.
Well, you know what? I found my means of expression. I found a survival tool, I think, because I was a bit of a misfit kid and, you know, didn't realize at that point that I was gay, but I knew that something was very different. And I found my music and my writing and my theater, and it sort of became my essence. It's something that defined me when I didn't really feel like I fit, you know.
Well, and you do a wonderful job of simultaneously loving your hometown,
mm-hmm.
but also realizing the limitations of that hometown, because when you and I grew up in Sand Springs, it was a blue-collar town for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, it's now sort of a bedroom suburb, and there's still those divides there. But
it was definitely blue-collar and democratic, by the way.
Yeah.
yeah, but it was also the time. I mean, you know, again, not to, like, focus on the gay thing, but that was part of it, was that there were, in that time, there were no role models anywhere. Nothing, nowhere. There was not a politician or an athlete or an actor or a singer or a writer or nothing. And so, you know, there's a lot of course, people are talking about bullying now and things going on, but this is a different world. There's access. You know you're not alone. And also, let's face it, this is the Bible Belt, you know, where it was not just outside. It was actually sinful and hell-burning. And I knew I wasn't a bad person. So it was trying to figure out how to put all those things together from the culture and the time, and trying to figure out who I was and be a good person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, Rich, we should specify, this is a book of mostly humorous stories.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And as the title implies...
Ham. Slices of a life. Yeah, I am a ham. Yeah. Let's just face it. I am a ham. Yep.
Should we tell the story that involves my mother?
Your mother is in the book. Well, she was my piano teacher, for one thing. She was everybody's piano teacher. But it was in second grade, and, you know, you had to be in third grade to play Santa Claus, which I did, by the way.
Yes, you were, and you were brilliant.
Thank you so much. A memorable performance. No, in second grade, I was, you know, relegated to a mere elf in the chorus. And your mother wrote an original show every year for the Christmas show for the elementary school. She was our teacher, our music teacher. And she wrote these original stories, which was, I look back on, it's kind of wonderful. We didn't just do, she wrote songs. And that year, the second grade, the story was that Santa had gone missing. And the year I played Santa, which is not in the book,
Went
to Hawaii.
That's right.
Because it was the moon. It was like the year of the moon or something.
Yeah. Moonshot.
Yeah. So, but anyway, in second grade, I was just a mere elf. And your mother had written a song. A simple song that went, ting-a-ling-a-ling, my phone is ringing, ting-a-ling-a-ling, who can it be? I remember it. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, dare do I answer, ting-a-ling-a-ling, I sweetly sing. And it was Mrs. Claus, who was terrified that no one could find Santa, and the phone was ringing, and she couldn't pick it up. She was so terrified. So she sang this song. Well, I'm in the chorus, is in my elf costume, with my little felt hat and the bell on the end. And the boom, dum, boom, 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 boom starts. And because I had loved the song and had been hearing it in my head and was probably subconsciously very upset that I wasn't playing Santa, I just started to sing. And I wasn't conscious. I just started to sing. And your mother looked at me and nodded like, no, don't stop. And Penny Bear, who was playing Mrs. Claus, looked at me with her hands on her hips like, what are you doing? Why are you interrupting my moment? And that's when I realized I was singing. And I was so horrified that I panicked. And then, of course, being the dramaturgical child that I was trying to figure out the audience. They must wonder why this elf is suddenly singing. Why is this elf suddenly concerned? Is he a distant relative who's come into the picture? Is he, you know, why? Like, how does this fit into the play? I couldn't come up with one reason. So I fled the stage and cried in the wings and... sat in a room outside the stage and listened to the applause after Penny sang her song. And I knew that it wasn't so much for her performance as it was for getting through after an upstart elf had tried to steal her moment in the sun or the snow, as it would seem. Yeah. And then I put in the book, it says, I put on my civilian clothes and waited by the car for my parents to take me home. That's in a chapter called Ham, in which I upstaged Penny unknowingly, and then it cuts to years later when I'm doing the Broadway national tour of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and we picked up about 40 local kids in every city, and there was this child that was supposed to be sitting at my feet, but he kept staring out at the audience, and then he would rise to be in my light, and then he started singing my part. He was like this ham. And I recognized him. I'm like, I know you. You're me. What are you?
And there's a very funny ending to that story, but we'll leave that for the book.
Yeah. Well, there's an incident with Donny Osmond later in which we both have the bug and he sort of tries to upstage me as well.
You know, it's very interesting. I mean, you're very self-aware. You know, one thing I knew about you growing up was that you were absolutely driven and you had that drive. And this is one thing that comes through the book is for people who, you know, we see on television, mm-hmm. in movies, on Broadway, on record, talent is not enough. It's got to be this incredible drive.
I don't want it.
Yeah. Can you talk about wanting it? Because you seem very self-aware about that.
I'm not sure I was at the time. Yeah, I did. I said it. I said, I am going to do this. I am going to be this. And again, I think it was out of a necessity to sort of define myself and give myself something focused and special because I didn't feel like I fit a part of anything. I mean, I talk in the book and it's all very funny, but I was obsessed with Judaism. And I think it was because anybody who was sort of oppressed and a minority, I needed to be a part of them, you know. And then it was with, I went to a black church and that became my everything. But oddly, these all became sort of an amalgam of my work and my music, my humor and my style. But it was trying to find a tribe. And of course, ultimately my tribe was show business. And I left home at an early age at 15 and came back for a minute and then left for good. And I've always had the drive. But it's oddly, there's something in the book that refers to the second kiss syndrome. And a friend told me that so many of us who are in approval-oriented professions are victims of the second kiss syndrome, or the first kiss syndrome, in which at some point in our youth, at one point our fathers gave us one kiss of encouragement, of unqualified yes, and we spend the rest of our lives trying to get the second kiss through our fathers, our friends, lovers, audiences. And I think that's partially true too. You know, I think we grew up in a time, Rich, when fathers did their careers. They were also having children when they were 20.
Right, right.
Didn't know themselves. And they were defining themselves. They were doing their, and mothers were for raising children. So there were a lot of fathers that were not necessarily completely present. And I think that with my dad, he's somebody that always, always supported me and always recognized my gifts. And they did both my parents. But there was always this fear, too, about me because they knew I was a little odd. They wanted me to be happy, and they weren't sure that was possible if I was a little odd.
Yeah, right. Well, they gave you enormous support. You talked about leaving home at 15 and 16. I mean, how many parents would say, okay, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, my God.
Move to Nashville. Or
I
move
can't
to,
even imagine.
Yeah.
You know, my kid's 5, almost 6, and I see, you know, 15-year-olds. I'm like, how could they do that? But they recognized it, and I was ready. I was ready. Yeah. They were quite amazing.
My guest today is Sam Harris. He is a star of Broadway. Films? Have you made films? Television, film, and of course, wonderful stage shows. And he was in Tulsa this past Saturday to promote his new book with a special performance, which I think what do you call it? A literusical. A literusical.
It's literary and musical.
The name of the book is Ham Slices of a Life. And he read from the book or told stories from the book and then sang a few songs over the weekend. And anyway, he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to talk about a couple of people that were really wonderful people in your life from growing up. Mm. And one was, as you well know, in Sand Springs at that time, Sand Springs was desegregated but incredibly segregated.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As you know, we could say that about Tulsa, too, at that time. And today, maybe somewhat. But Rochelle Chambers was a person, and you wrote in terms of you're talking about trying to find your spirituality and finding a tribe, if you will. Mm-hmm. She was just another student at the school, but she did some really amazing things for you.
Well, she was and is an incredibly gifted singer. I mean, she sang with this ease, this high, fluty. She was like a soulful violinist. Her voice, it just flipped and fluted. And my singing always came from this sort of a need that emerged in a cry, you know. And but we were kindred spirits in that we both loved music so much. And she kept asking me to come to church with her. And, you know, come to church then was always because you need to be saved. You need to be saved because Jesus needs your soul. And, you know, I had already been told basically that I was burning in hell and all this stuff. And so I had to sort of redefine my sense of God, not as something fearful, but as something more huggy than punishy, let's say. trying to work it out on my own. But Rochelle, this was in our sophomore year, had invited me to church. And finally, I said yes. And she came and picked me up. And we drove, you know, down from my middle class neighborhood through the poorer and poorer section of Sand Springs and crossed the tracks and went into Colored Town, which I'd only ever heard about, which was this 10-square block of clapboard houses with dry clay yards and no trees, a ghetto.
Right.
And at the end of it, there was a wooded area that from emerged this white plain brick church, very plain, and all of these people out front, you know, dressed for show, the ladies in particular in their turquoise and cranberries and polka dots and I think in the book I call it presumptuous architectural hats with matching shoes and gloves. And we went into this little church, and then this sort of spirited rhythm of a band started, which was nothing like I had ever heard in a
church
in
organ.
White
yeah,
church.
Right. Yeah,
just
right.
The, you know, the homogenous sort of. And this music started, and the people started singing with this glorious noise of individual experiences. And it was about change, and it was about faith, and it felt like it was singing to a happy God. I think in the book I wrote, a happy God who surely danced. And all of a sudden, this—and, you know, I was certainly familiar with the style, and Aretha Franklin was a huge influence on me, but this was different. This was not about how you sing. This was about why you sing. And I remember feeling this carnal joy sort of erupting through my body and then singing with them. And I was the only white person there. And, you know, it had only been like 13 years since the Civil Rights Act had been signed. And it was everything, as you said, it was hot and messy and red and personal, and change was happening. And this old woman was like Miss Jane Pittman was standing next to me. And I was singing full-throated gospel, and this woman took my hand with her crochet glove, and she said, "Hallelujah!" And what she had been through and what she had experienced in her life, and now this white boy is singing next to her in her church, it was an incredible moment for me, musically, spiritually, and it changed me. Rochelle had let me in. She had given me a secret, and I remember her smiling at me from she was sitting in with a choir. And it changed the way I heard music from that day forward, and the way I sang, and the way I looked at music.
And I think you wrote in the book that just, you know, it made me feel better about what I was doing because, you know, in Sand Springs, it was you had to be an athlete. And to be a singer was you were automatically segregated into your own little
That's
world.
True.
Yeah.
It was another tribe, too.
Yeah, it was.
Somebody that I fit that felt more natural to me than my own, you know.
Right. Another person that you write about was a teacher who, and you write about a suicide attempt.
I did.
And again, this feeling of not belonging, not feeling like you're, you know, this whole guilt trip
I'd always been sort of burdened with these secrets. And I went away, when I went away for the summer the first time, and I came back and I felt more outside. Also, I had fallen in love. I had had my first relationship. The sweet, innocent relationship. And I came back and it was worse because now, and I couldn't express that. I couldn't share that.
To anybody.
To anyone.
Yeah.
And so it was like this finally something had happened to me. You know, everybody else was dating this one and doing that. Something had happened to me and I couldn't share it. It couldn't even be acknowledged. And the idea that that would be denigrated was even worse than my own secret, you know? And I became severely depressed. But, you know, I had learned to wear the Sam mask for so long and with my broad grin and my busy and I'm this and it was not flying. And I realized that I couldn't do it. And I just kept sinking lower like this weight, this loitering weight that I finally could not crawl from beneath and then didn't want to. and decided that the best thing to do was to kill myself. It's hard to say. And I sought out a friend who'd been offering me drugs since the seventh grade, and he happily supplied, and I got a bag of Seconals, and I took them. My parents were out on a rare date night, and I took them, all 30 of them, and was starting to feel the effects, and then I heard a blood-curdling scream, and my brother had stepped on my grandmother's darning needle, and it had broken off in his foot. So all of a sudden, I had to be of service. I had to help my brother and call a neighbor, and do I call an ambulance? What do I do? And then I realized in the midst of this crisis that I was kind of groggy and had taken 30 Seconals. It was like, oh, it's not my night. So I forced myself to throw them up, and I drank milk and threw them up more. But oddly, being with my brother and telling him that everything would be all right in the way that I was so desperate to be comforted myself gave me a sense of value enough to sort of keep me on holding on a little longer. And you ask about the teacher. His name is Wayne McDowell, and he was the psychology teacher. And you had him. He was somebody who just did not take the norm for the norm, taught us to think outside the box, research stuff. Do not take what you hear as gospel. Investigate. You can't know truth until you investigate. And he was like, he was just a force. He taught psychology, but not only for the class, but for the individual. He sensed things. He would point out things to us individually, right? What did he say to you?
He said I was lazy. He was right.
but he sensed something and started to just ask me how I was. And then he heard me asking around for a ride after school and offered me a ride home in his truck and just gave me his home number and said, if you ever need to talk about anything, let me know. Very just innocent, nothing on it, no gravity. But the suicide concept was still floating in my head. Like it was saving me, actually. It was kind of keeping me alive, kind of like a go-to, mm-hmm. like the friend who would be there in case nobody showed up. And I didn't want to die, right? And I thought maybe McDowell might be the one to show up. So I called him. It was so terrifying. And I called him, and those rings were interminable. And he came to the phone, and he said, why don't we meet before school tomorrow morning? And we came in, and it was very early, and I was afraid he wouldn't show up or wouldn't think it was important enough. And then he comes, and there was an ease about him. And I finally said, I'm different. And he said, thank God for that, you know? And he just said, and I finally just said everything. I said I was gay. I told him about falling in love. I told him about the Seconal. I waited for shock to register. I waited for him to have this reaction or something. Nothing. He just listened. He listened. In the book I write, he listened with a kind of active intensity that most people have only when talking. And when I had exhausted myself, he said, there is nothing wrong with you. And those were the words that I had been waiting for anybody to say. And then he pulled out an American Psychiatric Association book that showed me that 5 years prior, homosexuality had been declassified as a mental disorder. Because, Rich, all the information that I was a research freak, partly because of him.
And you are who you are, and you say,
I want to know. Yeah. But I hid it. I tore out the innards of a encyclopedia and would hide books behind it and read them at night and take notes on a legal pad, like I was case studying. But all of the information that I got was that it was pathological, that it was perverted, that it was a mental disorder. I write in the book, you know, he shows me this thing in the American Psychiatric Association that had been declassified, and I was like, if only the Sand Springs Library had been up to date. If only the Sand Springs Library, you know. And I remember it couldn't be this simple, and I started arguing and pulled out my notes and said, this person says this, and this person says this, and I started quoting the Bible. And I started fighting the other side because I couldn't have gone through this kind of anguish for it to be that simple. And he also said, I can't say it on the air, but he also said, I said, what about all these people? What about what they think? He said, they're wrong. They're just wrong. And also, some people are a-holes. And I laughed, you know. He was a human being, and he saved my life. And, Rich, he came to my show the other night, And in this show, which is not, it's not just readings with songs. It's like a play. It's a story. It's more linear than the book. And the songs come out of the stories and move the plot forward. And this story and this scene, it becomes a scene, was in it. And I had I tried to track McDowell down and finally found him and a few weeks ago and said, I wrote this. And do you remember this? Because, you know, we affect people sometimes and we don't even know.
Yeah.
He said, oh, I remember very well. Because it was quite, and I said, I've written about this, and I sent him the book, and I said, I'm coming to town, I'm doing a show, and the story's going to be in here, do you want to come? And he came. And to have him in the audience was so surreal and huge for me, and my parents in the audience, and other characters in the book that are real people that were there. It was trippy. And then I'm at home at my folks' house sitting in the room where I took the pills, you know, and all the funny stuff, all the silly funny.
Yeah.
And now here I am, a well-situated, super happy guy, married, legally married. I have a child. I won the race.
You did.
I won the race. And I get to be not a voice just that's just a means of expression for myself, but for every, you know, for lots of misfits and lots of people who couldn't find their niche and then found their place and their tools to be of service.
Yeah.
And this is not a self-help book. This is a funny, entertaining, humorous book. It doesn't sound like it, does it, Rich?
I can vouch for you it is, and there's some wonderful stories.
Lots of showbiz stories.
Lots of showbiz stories. We're out of time, unfortunately, because I wanted to, you know, you talked about Aretha Franklin. And
horrible story. Terrible story in the book. Yeah, just a nightmare of us working together.
You are known for, you know, Liza Minnelli's a wonderful friend,
yeah.
Frank Langella, and
yeah.
many people, legends in the business are close friends. Aretha, maybe not so much.
It was a horrible experience. I was singing, I'd been asked to open for her in Cleveland. This was right after Star Search and when I was sort of hit the scene. And it was just the confluence of every horrible, unimaginable nightmare between her tardiness, a crazy promoter, a blizzard in Cleveland. It was the worst experience, and yet it turned into something that, pulling from my theatrical roots, I did what I knew how to do to sort of save the day for myself. So it was all of the stories that mention celebrity things are really not tell-alls. It's never mean-spirited. It's always about sort of my journey and figuring out where I fit in this piece, you know, mostly humorous way.
It is. It is. The name of the book is Ham, Slices of a Life. Sam, pleasure as always.
You are great. Thank you.
Recording artist, singer, actor, and writer Sam Harris speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled Ham, Slices of a Life. It's published by Gallery Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Look through our archives and listen on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.